in the face and in the groove, tech tales and funding blaze. Welcome to Startup Jazz. Startup Jazz.
And a warm welcome back to Startup Jazz, the show where we break down the rhythm of the startup world, one story at a time. I'm George.
And I'm Michelle. It's great to be back with you all for episode 6. George, I have to say, that intro music gets me hyped up every single time. It feels like the beginning of a great set.
That's the idea, Michelle. It's our walk-on music. You gotta start with energy. It's like a great band leader kicking things off with a four count that just grabs the entire room. You want the audience leaning in from the very first note. And we have a show today that I hope will do exactly that.
We absolutely do. We're diving into some really foundational topics today, things that every founder, operator, and investor needs to be thinking about. It feels like we're getting back to basics, but with a very modern 2025 lens.
Couldn't have said it better. It's about revisiting the classics, but with a new arrangement. First up, we're going to be talking about something that sounds incredibly boring, but is catastrophically important: data backups. An article from Entrepreneur outlines 6 common mistakes that even established, well-funded companies are making, and the consequences are, well, they're not pretty.
Not at all. It's the kind of thing you ignore at your own peril. Then, we're wading into a classic debate, but one that's been supercharged by AI. The question is, do founders still need to learn to code? Another piece from Entrepreneur makes a very compelling case for why, even with tools like ChatGPT and Copilot, the answer is a resounding yes.
It's a fantastic piece. It argues you don't have to be a virtuoso soloist, you don't need to be John Coltrane on the saxophone, but you absolutely need to know your scales. You need to understand the fundamentals to lead the band.
Exactly. And finally, we're following the money. A new report from Crunchbase is highlighting a sector that is seeing an absolute explosion in venture funding this year: AI in healthcare. We're talking billions of dollars, staggering valuations, and startups raising multiple mega rounds in the span of a few months. We'll break down who's getting funded and why this space is so hot right now.
It's a packed set list, so let's not vamp any longer. Let's get right into it. Michelle, kick us off with this piece on data backup mistakes.
Happy to. The article is from Entrepreneur, titled 6 Common Data Backup Mistakes That Established Businesses Make and the Costly Consequences That Follow. And the core premise is fascinating because it's not aimed at tiny startups with no budget. It's specifically calling out large, established companies, the ones with big IT departments and professional solutions, and saying, you're still getting it wrong.
And that's what's so jarring. You'd assume the Goliaths of the industry have this on lockdown. It's like finding out a world-famous concert hall has a faulty sound system. How is that even possible?
Well, the article points to some very specific, very human-centric failures. The first mistake it highlights is simply having long intervals between backups. It cites a report that says while 91% of organizations back up their data in some form, only 26%, just over a quarter, actually do it daily. Most are doing it weekly or even monthly.
That's terrifying. In today's world, a week of lost data isn't an inconvenience. It's a potential company killer. The article uses the Walmart example. They handle 2.5 petabytes of data every hour. Losing even an hour would be a multi-million dollar catastrophe. For a fast-moving startup, losing a week of customer data, product development, or financial records could be the end of the story.
Precisely. And that leads directly into the second mistake, which I think is even more damning: failing to test the backup recovery process regularly. This is the big one for me. The article quotes a statistic that over 50% of all backups fail when you actually try to restore the data.
50%? That's a coin flip. It's pure backup theater. You're diligently doing the work, you're paying for the storage, you think you're safe, but you've never actually checked if the fire extinguisher works. It's like a band that spends months rehearsing in the studio, but never ever does a sound check before a live gig. You hit the stage, the lights come up, and you realize the lead guitar isn't plugged into the amp. all that preparation is useless at the one moment it matters.
That is the perfect analogy. And the article says leaders often see testing as an expensive chore. They don't want to dedicate resources to a test run. But compare that cost to the cost of a failed recovery after a real disaster, like a ransomware attack. It's not even in the same ballpark. The recommendation is that large organizations should test recovery quarterly at a minimum and weekly for their most critical data.
That feels right. You have to treat it like a fire drill. It should be a non-negotiable part of your operational rhythm.
The third mistake is a bit more technical, but equally critical: not being able to restore a backup to a different device quickly. Imagine your main server gets fried, or an executive's laptop with critical data is stolen. You buy a new machine, but it has a completely different hardware configuration. If your backup software can't do what's called a bare metal restore, making the new machine a bootable, identical clone of the old one, you're stuck. You have to manually install the operating system, all the applications, and then try to port the data over. The article points out this kills your recovery time objective, or RTO.
It turns a one-step recovery process into a week-long IT nightmare. And time is everything in a crisis. You need to get the music playing again as fast as possible. You can't afford a long, silent intermission while your team fumbles around backstage trying to figure out how the new equipment works.
Then we get into the location paradox. Mistakes 4 and 5 are two sides of the same coin. Mistake 4 is keeping all your backups in a single physical location. A lot of companies, especially older ones, like the idea of an in-house data center. They think keeping it within the company is safer. But as the article points out, that's a disaster waiting to happen. A fire, a flood, a simple theft, and everything is gone. Your primary data and your backup data, all wiped out in one event.
The classic all your eggs in one basket problem.
Exactly. But then mistake 5 is the modern version of that, relying only on a remote cloud backup. People think, oh, it's in the cloud, it's invincible. But the article brings up the massive fire at the OVH cloud data center in France a few years ago. Millions of websites went down. Government agencies, banks, businesses, gone. And any of them that didn't have a separate, local, or alternative cloud backup lost everything, permanently.
This really highlights the need for a hybrid strategy. Relying only on a single cloud provider is like a jazz trio where the bassist lives in another state and connects via Zoom. Sure, it might work most of the time, but when you really need that tight, responsive, low-end foundation for a complex solo, the latency is going to kill the performance. You need a local copy you can access instantly and a remote copy for disaster recovery. It's the famous 3-2-1 rule. 3 copies of your data on 2 different types of media with at least 1 copy off-site.
That's the gold standard. Which brings us to the final mistake, number 6, having no cold backup. And this is the ultimate defense against the scariest threat out there right now, which is ransomware.
Explain what a cold backup is for our listeners who might not be familiar.
A cold backup is a copy of your data that is completely offline. It's on an external hard drive or tape that is physically disconnected from any computer or network. This is often called an air-gapped backup. The reason it's so crucial is that modern ransomware is insidious. When it infects your system, it actively seeks out and encrypts everything it can connect to, including your live online backups in the cloud or on your network.
So your connected backups get taken hostage right along with your primary data.
Exactly. But the ransomware can't touch a hard drive that's sitting in a safe on the other side of the building, completely unplugged. That air-gapped copy is your last line of defense. It's your get-out-of-jail-free card.
It's your sheet music. The power can go out at the venue, the amps can blow, the PA system can die, but if the whole band has the written composition, you can still gather around a piano and play the song. You have the core, uncorrupted source material safe and sound. A cold backup is the fundamental composition of your company's data, protected from any electronic catastrophe.
I love that. And the article closes by putting a price tag on this, noting that a 1,000-employee organization might spend anywhere from $267,000 to $675,000 a year on data backup and recovery. That sounds like a lot, but when you weigh it against the cost of a data breach or total data loss, which can easily run into the tens of millions, it's not just a good investment, it's essential insurance. For startups, the numbers are smaller, but the principle is identical. Skipping these steps isn't saving money, it's just taking on an unquantifiable amount of risk.
Absolutely. It's foundational. You can have the most innovative product in the world, but if your data isn't secure, tested, and recoverable, you're building your masterpiece on a stage that could collapse at any moment. A sobering but incredibly important topic. All right, from the foundations of security to the foundations of creation. Michelle, let's talk about our second article, Don't Let AI Fool You. Here's why every founder still needs to learn to code. This one feels like it's pouring a little cold water on the AI hype train.
It is, but in a very constructive way. The author isn't an AI pessimist. In fact, they argue that AI makes it easier than ever to learn technical skills. The core argument is that while you don't need a computer science degree, a baseline understanding of coding is still a massive advantage for any founder, especially a non-technical one.
The analogy they use right at the top is brilliant: renovating your kitchen. You can have this perfect vision in your head, but if you have zero knowledge of carpentry, plumbing, or design, you're completely at the mercy of your contractors. You can't tell if their timeline is realistic, if the materials are overpriced, or if the work is shoddy. But with just a little knowledge, you're empowered. You can ask intelligent questions and manage the project effectively.
It's such a perfect metaphor for a non-technical founder managing a team of developers. And the article breaks this down into three key benefits. The first is the ability to build your own minimum viable product, or MVP. This is especially critical for bootstrapped founders who don't have a pile of cash to hire a dev agency before they've even validated their idea.
This is where the rubber meets the road. If you can personally stitch together the first clunky version of your product, you can get it in front of users and see if anyone cares. You can test your core hypothesis without spending a dime on salaries.
And they give a killer example. A company called Base 44, launched by a developer named Mayor Shlomo. He used AI to help him build the MVP himself very quickly. Within weeks, it had 100,000 users, and by mid-2025, it was acquired by Wix for around $80 million. The point isn't that you need to be a senior engineer like he was, but that the ability to tinker and build that first version yourself gives you incredible speed and reduces your burn rate to near zero.
You control your own tempo. You're not waiting for someone else to interpret your vision. You can sit down at the piano yourself and work out the melody. It might be simple, it might be rough, but it's real, and you can play it for people today.
The second benefit the article focuses on is being able to manage your programmers better. This goes right back to that kitchen analogy. A working knowledge of code helps you understand what your developers are building. You can ask better questions. You can understand why a seemingly simple feature request is actually a massive architectural challenge.
It builds a bridge of communication. You're not just saying, "I want this." You can have a conversation about how it gets built. It helps you distinguish between elegant, scalable code and a quick and dirty patch job that's going to create a mountain of technical debt down the line.
It also makes hiring so much easier. The author, a proud bootstrapper, mentions that because they had worn all the hats, coding, marketing, customer support, they knew exactly what to look for when they made their first hire. They could separate the candidates who just talked a good game from those who could actually deliver. If you can't read a single line of code, how do you effectively interview a CTO? You're basically hiring on faith.
You're just listening to their solo and hoping it's good without understanding the theory behind it. You might be impressed by flashy, fast playing, but you can't tell if it's musically coherent or just noise. A little bit of knowledge lets you understand the structure, the harmony, the intent behind the code.
And this is where the AI part comes in, which is the third and most modern point the article makes. The barrier to learning to code has never been lower because of AI. This is the crucial twist. AI isn't a reason to not learn. It's a supercharger for the learning process itself.
Right. This is not about replacing the musician. It's about giving the student an infinitely patient, knowledgeable tutor.
Precisely. Tools like GitHub Copilot, ChatGPT, Replit's Ghostwriter, they act like a partner. They can suggest code, explain complex errors in plain English, and walk you through debugging. The author notes that what used to take hours of frustrated searching on Stack Overflow can now be solved in minutes with an AI assistant. It smooths out that brutally steep learning curve that causes so many people to give up.
So the argument is that AI is democratizing the ability to learn, which in turn makes the excuse of "I'm not a technical person" less and less valid. It's like using one of those apps that listens to you play piano and tells you in real time if you hit a wrong note. It doesn't play for you, but it accelerates your learning exponentially.
That's it. So you still have to put in the work. You still have to learn the fundamentals. But the process is faster, less intimidating, and more interactive than ever before. The article concludes by saying you don't need to be the world's best engineer. You just need to know enough. Because when you understand the basics, you're not just dreaming up the kitchen. You're an active participant in building it on your own terms.
I find that so compelling. The temptation with generative AI is to see it as a magic black box that lets you skip the hard work. But the real power, the sustainable advantage, comes from using it as a tool to augment your own knowledge. Using AI to code without knowing the basics is like using a synthesizer to perfectly replicate the sound of a saxophone. It might sound okay from a distance, but anyone who truly understands music can tell it lacks the breath, the nuance, the soul of a real player. You can't truly improvise with it because you don't understand the instrument. Learning the fundamentals, even just the basics, allows you to use AI as a true creative partner, not a crutch.
And in the startup world, that partnership, that ability to build, validate, manage, and hire with confidence is an incredible competitive edge.
What an edge indeed. And speaking of competitive edges, let's shift gears to a sector where billions of dollars are flowing to startups that are creating just that. Michelle, tell us about this Crunchbase report on AI in healthcare.
This one is a jaw-dropper. The piece is titled Crunchbase Sector Snapshot: Funding to AI-Related Healthcare Startups is Robust This Year. And robust feels like a massive understatement. The numbers are staggering. Investors have poured an estimated $10.7 billion into AI-powered health tech companies so far this year.
$10.7 billion. And what's the time frame on so far this year?
We're recording this in late October 2025, so in less than 10 months. To put that in perspective, that $10.7 billion is already 24% higher than the total for all of 2024, which was $8.6 billion. The funding has accelerated dramatically.
Wow, so the music has gotten a lot louder and a lot faster. What's driving this explosion of investment? Why now?
The article points to a confluence of factors, citing a recent report from Menlo Ventures. First, the healthcare industry is a gargantuan $4.9 trillion market in the U.S. alone, but it's notoriously behind on technology. The author gives a personal anecdote about being handed a CD with their X-ray images on it at a recent ER visit. That says it all. There's a massive need for innovation.
A CD-ROM. That's like a band still releasing their music on cassette tape. It's charmingly retro until you realize it's the only way to listen, and then it's just painfully inefficient. The healthcare industry has been playing the same old standard, the same tired arrangement, for decades. These AI startups are coming in with a completely new sound, injecting bebop energy into a slow, sleepy waltz, and it sounds like investors are finally hearing that new rhythm and rushing to the dance floor.
They are rushing, and they're placing their bets on the newcomers. This is a key finding from the Menlo report. 85% of all generative AI spending in healthcare is flowing to startups, not the big legacy incumbents like Epic or Cerner. The startups are capturing the vast majority of the new spend.
The nimble jazz combo is outmaneuvering the slow, cumbersome orchestra. That makes sense. They can innovate faster.
much faster, and adoption is picking up speed. The report found that 22% of healthcare organizations have now implemented domain-specific AI tools. That's a 7x increase over 2024 and a 10x increase over 2023. The demand is clearly there, and it's hitting an inflection point.
So where exactly is the money going? What are the subsectors within AI health that are getting these huge checks?
The report highlights several, backed by some incredible funding announcements. The biggest round of the year went to Isomorphic Labs, a Google spinoff using AI for drug discovery. They raised $600 million back in March. This is about fundamentally accelerating the process of developing new medicines.
The really deep, complex science.
Right. But a lot of the other big winners are focused on the administrative and clinical workflow side, the stuff that causes massive costs and physician burnout. A company called Abridge, for example, uses AI to listen to patient-doctor conversations and automatically generate structured clinical notes. They raised a $250 million Series D in February, and then, just 4 months later, a $300 million Series E, valuing them at $5.3 billion.
Hold on. Two rounds totaling over $500 million in 4 months? For a company that automates note-taking?
That's the scale of the problem. Medical documentation and back-office revenue cycle management make up nearly 60% of all healthcare IT spending. It's a huge pain point. Doctors spend hours every day on paperwork instead of with patients. Abridge solves that, and their funding velocity is not unique here. The report highlights several companies raising at a blistering pace.
That kind of rapid, successive funding is incredible. It's not just a musician playing a great solo. That's a whole big band hitting a stride, with every section, the brass, the woodwinds, the rhythm, locking in and firing on all cylinders. The market is providing a powerful driving beat, and these companies are just layering hit after hit on top of it.
That's a great way to put it. Look at Open Evidence. They provide AI-powered medical search and clinical decision support for doctors. In February, they raised a $925 million Series A.
A nearly billion-dollar Series A?
A unicorn right out of the gate. Then, in July, they followed up with a $210 million Series B. And in October, they added another $200 million Series C, valuing them at $6 billion. That's three massive rounds in just over 8 months. Another one, Lila Sciences, working on a scientific superintelligence platform, secured three rounds in 7 months for a total of $550 million in 2025 alone.
The velocity is just breathtaking. It signals an intense land grab. VCs see a massive, inefficient market that is finally ready for technological disruption, and they are pouring gasoline on the fire for the companies that show early traction.
Absolutely. And it's not just the mega deals. The article mentions smaller but still significant rounds for companies tackling other parts of the workflow. Attuned Intelligence raised $13 million to build AI agents for hospital call centers. Honey Health raised $7.8 million for AI agents that log into existing electronic health records and automate administrative tasks. They're all chipping away at that mountain of inefficiency.
So we have drug discovery, clinical documentation, decision support, and back office automation. It's a full stack assault on the problems of healthcare. But what are the risks here, Michelle? This much money flowing this fast can sometimes lead to overheating. Are there storm clouds on the horizon?
There are definitely significant challenges. The article doesn't go deep on this, but we know the hurdles in healthcare are immense. You have strict data privacy regulations like HIPAA. You have long sales cycles selling into conservative hospital systems. There are huge technical challenges in integrating with clunky legacy EHR systems. And most importantly, in a clinical setting, the stakes are life and death. An AI hallucination in a chatbot is funny. An AI hallucination in a diagnostic tool could be fatal. So the need for accuracy, reliability, and FDA oversight is paramount.
So the upside is transforming a multi-trillion-dollar industry, but the execution risk is incredibly high.
These startups have to be flawless. They have to be the Thelonious Monk of startups, technically brilliant, wildly innovative, but never, ever missing a note.
That's the bar. But the broad takeaway from Crunchbase is clear. The tech is finally good enough, the need is more urgent than ever, and investors are seeing a clear path to building massive, profitable companies. The AI healthcare boom is very real, and it's happening right now.
Fantastic analysis, Michelle. Three huge topics, each with so much to unpack. We've covered the critical foundations of data security, the essential skills for modern founders, and a market that is absolutely on fire.
And that was just our opening set. We've got a lot more to cover.
We do indeed. We're just taking a short solo break. When we come back for the second half of our set, we'll be diving into some fascinating new trends in consumer products and venture capital. And we'll cap it all off with a deep dive on a deep tech company that just hit a massive milestone. You won't want to miss it. And we are back for the second half of Startup Jazz, Episode 6. If you're just tuning in, you've missed a wild first set, but don't worry, the closing act is always where the real magic happens. I'm George, and as always, I'm joined by the incomparable Michelle.
Thanks, George. In the first half, we covered some absolutely critical foundations, from the do's and don'ts of data backups to why founders still need to code and the explosion of VC funding into AI healthcare. Now, we're changing tempo completely. We're moving from the digital to the physical, starting with something you can hold in your hand and, well, drink.
Ah, the beverage space. It's one of the most crowded stages in the startup world. It's like a Saturday night jam session at the Blue Note. Everybody wants a solo, but only the truly unique voices cut through the noise. To stand out, you can't just play the standards, you have to bring a whole new sound.
That's the perfect way to frame it, because a recent piece from Crunchbase News titled "Startups Are Serving Up Drinks with Protein, Caffeine, and a Shot of Wellness" really dives into what that new sound is. The article highlights three major trends: protein packing, energy boosting, and wellness infusion. Essentially, consumers don't just want a drink anymore. They want a functional experience in a can.
They want their beverage to do something. Quenching thirst is just a cover charge. The real value is in the performance. Does it build muscle? Does it sharpen your focus? Does it help you unwind? That's the melody people are paying for.
Exactly. And while the article mentions a bunch of interesting players, like Slate Milk, which is packing its shakes with protein, and Don't Quit, a protein-infused soda, the one that really caught my eye was in the wellness category, a company called HEO.
HEO? Tell me more. The name itself has a nice, light, upbeat feel.
It does. HEO makes what they call social tonics. These are sparkling, non-alcoholic beverages crafted with functional ingredients like adaptogens, nootropics, and botanicals. Things like ashwagandha, L-theanine, and lion's mane mushroom. The whole idea is to give you a pleasant, mood-boosting feeling, a little lift, without any alcohol. They're positioning themselves as a sophisticated alternative for social occasions.
So it's the feeling of a well-crafted cocktail, but without the next day regrets. It's all the smooth, mellow tones of a Chet Baker trumpet solo without the potential for a crashing cymbal of a hangover. I like that. That's a very specific vibe they're composing.
It is, and it's tapping into the massive, sober, curious movement. But what makes HEO particularly fascinating from a business perspective is who's listening to their music. Earlier this year, they sold a minority stake to Constellation Brands through its venture arm. For those who don't know, Constellation is a liquor giant. They own brands like Corona, Modelo, Svedka Vodka, and Robert Mondavi Wine.
Whoa, hold on. That is a major plot twist. That's like the conductor of the New York Philharmonic suddenly getting super into a minimalist, experimental free jazz trio from Brooklyn. It's a huge signal. The incumbents, the masters of the old standard, are not just acknowledging the new sound, they're actively investing in it. One a piece of the action.
It's a classic, if you can't beat 'em, join 'em. And it's incredibly smart. Constellation sees the writing on the wall. A growing segment of consumers, particularly younger ones, are drinking less alcohol. So they're hedging. They're diversifying their portfolio to include the very thing that threatens their core business. The investment amount wasn't disclosed, but getting that stamp of approval, and more importantly, access to Constellation's distribution network and market expertise, is invaluable for a startup like HIO.
It's more than invaluable. It's a golden ticket. Distribution is the hardest part of the beverage business. Getting on the shelf is a brutal, expensive fight. Having a heavyweight champion like Constellation in your corner changes the entire dynamic. They're no longer a small combo trying to get a gig. They've got a world-class promoter booking them into the best venues.
Let's talk about the market and the risks, though. The non-alcoholic, functional beverage space is getting just as crowded as you said. HIO is competing with brands like Kin Euphorics, Gia, and Seedlip, all of whom have strong brand identities and loyal followings. The big opportunity is to become the go-to brand for social settings, to really own that night out without alcohol occasion.
And the biggest risk, as with any beverage, comes down to one simple thing: taste. It can have all the magical ingredients in the world, it can be backed by the biggest company on the planet, but if it doesn't taste good, people will not buy it a second time. That's the foundational rhythm section of the whole operation. If the bass and drums aren't locked in, it doesn't matter how flashy the trumpet solo is. The whole song falls apart.
That's the absolute truth. And there's another, more subtle risk. The claims themselves, words like mood boosting and stress relieving, are powerful marketing tools, but they can be tricky to substantiate. You walk a fine line between promoting wellness benefits and making unsubstantiated health claims that could attract regulatory scrutiny. They have to be very careful with their messaging.
They have to find the right harmony. The brand promise, the functional ingredients, the flavor profile, and the marketing all have to work together in a perfectly balanced chord. If one of those notes is flat, the consumer will hear it immediately. But if HIO can nail that harmony with the backing of a giant like Constellation, they could very well define the sound of social drinking for the next generation. It's a fascinating space to watch.
It really is. And it's a great example of how consumer preferences are driving innovation in even the most established industries. But from the startups making the drinks, let's pivot to the people funding them. George, let's talk about the venture capitalists.
Let's do it. We've talked about the musicians. Now let's talk about the record labels and the producers. A Crunchbase news article from last month, "Active U.S. Investors Kept Busy Cutting Checks in October," gives us a great look at the current tempo of the venture market.
And the names at the top of the charts will be familiar to anyone who follows the space. The article broke it down by a few metrics, but across the board, the same firms kept appearing. For most active overall, Andreessen Horowitz, or A16Z, was number one. Sequoia Capital and General Catalyst were tied for second, with Accel not far behind.
No surprises there. These firms are the established band leaders of the venture capital world. They're the Duke Ellingtons and the Count Basies. They have massive, talented orchestras, their networks of founders, experts, and operators, and they have a reputation that attracts the absolute best new soloists, the startups. The article shows that even in a market that has felt cooler and more reserved over the past year, these band leaders are still actively writing new arrangements and bringing new talent onto the stage.
But what's really striking is what kind of music they're commissioning. The article explicitly states they are backing an AI-dominated assortment of large rounds. This is underscored when you look at the highest spending lead investors. The number one name on that list, by a massive margin, was NVIDIA.
The chipmaker.
And it was almost entirely due to them leading a colossal $2 billion Series B for a company called Reflection.ai. Think about that. The most capital deployed by a lead investor in the month came from a strategic corporate player, not a traditional VC, and it went into one giant AI deal. What does that tell you about where the energy is in the market right now?
It tells me that the VCs are all huddled around the AI piano, and they're mesmerized. The AI pianist is playing something so new, so dazzling, so complex, that everyone else in the band has to strain to be heard. If you're, say, a sass saxophone player in the corner or a fintech drummer,
you have to play something truly extraordinary to get the audience and the investors to turn their heads. The bar for 9 AI companies to get funded, especially at a large scale, feels significantly higher right now.
That's the big takeaway. The concentration of capital is immense. It creates a feedback loop. AI gets the funding, which attracts the best talent, which leads to more breakthroughs, which attracts even more funding. For founders outside that sphere, it can be a challenging environment. The article also looked at the seed stage, where Y Combinator continues to dominate, holding its customary spot in first place. But even their pace slowed down month over month.
That's an interesting little detail. YC is like the legendary proving ground, the village vanguard of the startup world. It's where the next generation of greats are discovered. A slower pace might not necessarily be a bad thing. It could just mean they're being more curatorial. In a hype-driven market, it's easy to pack the club every night with decent acts. But maybe now they're being more selective, looking for the next Thelonious Monk, someone with a truly unique, category-defining style, not just another competent player who knows the standards.
So if we synthesize all this, the picture of the venture market is this. The top tier, established firms are still very active, but they are increasingly focused on and concentrating their capital in large AI rounds. This creates a haves and have-nots dynamic. The opportunities for AI-native companies are historic, but the risk is a potential bubble where valuations get detached from reality. For everyone else, the risk is being overlooked. What's your advice to a founder in this climate, George?
You have to focus on your fundamentals. You have to have an undeniable groove. In jazz, that's the baseline. It's not always the flashiest part of the song, but it is the foundation. It's what everything else is built on. For a startup, that baseline is your unit economics, your customer love, your revenue, your path to profitability. In a market where investors are distracted by a spectacular piano solo, a strong, steady, and compelling baseline becomes more important than ever. It shows you have substance, not just style.
That's fantastic advice. You have to be so good, they can't ignore you, AI or not. And that brings us perfectly to our final company of the day. It's a company that required an immense amount of capital, is definitely not a pure software play, and just hit a major milestone that we haven't seen much of lately. We're talking about Beta Technologies and its IPO.
An IPO? In this economy? That's a rare tune these days. Hitting the public markets right now is like a jazz artist not only getting a major record deal, but immediately booking a sold-out headlining show at Carnegie Hall. It's a massive moment of validation, especially for a company in a sector as ambitious as electric aircraft.
It really is. The Crunchbase News article, Electric Aircraft Upstart, Beta, Rises in First Day Trading, lays out the details. Beta Technologies, which is based in South Burlington, Vermont, designs and manufactures electric aircraft, specifically what are known as EVTOLs, for Electric Vertical Takeoff and Landing. They also build the charging infrastructure to support them.
So, flying cars. We're finally talking about flying cars.
Essentially, yes. Or at least a modern, electric, more practical version. They priced their IPO at $34 a share, a bit above their expected range, and closed their first day of trading at $36, up about 6%. The offering brought in just over $1 billion for the company. Now, a 6% pop isn't the kind of wild 100% surge we saw in the ZIRP era IPOs, but most analysts are calling this a huge success.
I would argue that a modest, solid pop is much healthier. A crazy first-day spike is often a sign of mispricing. It means the company left a lot of money on the table. A 6% rise is not a wild, out-of-control trumpet blast that's impossible to sustain. It's a solid, confident opening chord. It suggests the bankers priced it correctly and that there's steady institutional interest, not just a frenzy of retail speculation. It's a foundation they can build on.
And they will need that foundation, because this is the definition of a long-term, capital-intensive business. Let's look at their model and their financials. Beta is targeting four main use cases: cargo and logistics, medical transport, defense, and eventually passenger transportation. They're focusing on the short-haul market, flights of 300 miles or less. But here's the key part. Their aircraft are not yet commercially operating. They are not yet certified by the FAA.
Ah, so the main product isn't actually generating revenue yet.
Correct. They did have some revenue, $15.6 million in the first half of this year, but that comes from other sources, like selling electric motors and providing engineering services. Meanwhile, their net loss for that same period was $159 million. So investors in this IPO are not buying a proven business model. They are buying a vision of the future.
This is a long-form composition. This isn't a three-minute pop single. This is John Coltrane's A Love Supreme. It's a multi-part suite that takes time to unfold. It requires immense patience from the listener, the investor, because the big transcendent payoff doesn't happen in the first few bars. That early revenue from motors and services is like the opening theme. It introduces the musical ideas, but it's just a hint of the full symphony to come. You're investing in the entire piece.
And the people who are investing are some of the biggest names out there. Looking at their pre-IPO stakeholders is like reading a who's who of venture and corporate capital. Fidelity owned 14.5%. General Electric had over 10%. TPG's Rise Climate Fund had almost 9%. And maybe most tellingly, Amazon's Climate Pledge Fund owned over 6%.
Wow, they have assembled an absolute all-star band. That is not a garage band trying to figure things out. That is a certified supergroup. You have the steady, long-term rhythm of a financial giant like Fidelity. You have the industrial might and engineering power of GE on drums. You have the forward-looking, market-making vision of Amazon on bass. That kind of backing doesn't just provide capital, it provides credibility. It dramatically de-risks the venture from a partnership and go-to-market perspective. If Amazon is a major shareholder, you can bet Beta's cargo and logistics use case is very, very real.
It has to be, but let's not downplay the risks, because they are monumental. First, this is a hardware company. Manufacturing at scale is incredibly difficult and expensive. We've seen titans like Tesla talk about production hell, and Beta will have to navigate that. Second, the competition is fierce. You have other well-funded players like Joby Aviation and Archer Aviation, who also went public via SPAC, racing to do the exact same thing.
It's a high-stakes battle of the bands, all playing for the same prize.
Exactly. And that prize is only attainable after clearing the single biggest hurdle of all, FAA certification. This is a years-long, incredibly rigorous, and somewhat unpredictable process. You are creating a new category of aircraft. The regulators have to be 1,000% certain that these vehicles are safe before they allow them to carry goods, let alone people, over populated areas. Everything hinges on successfully navigating that process.
The FAA certification is the ultimate key change. It's the most complex, difficult chord progression in the entire piece of music. They have to navigate it perfectly with technical precision and regulatory grace. One wrong note, one misstep, and the entire composition could fall apart. The amount of risk is staggering, but the potential reward to literally create a new form of transportation is equally massive. Their ability to execute this incredibly difficult technical and regulatory improvisation will determine if they become a footnote or a legend.
A perfect summary. Beta Technologies is a testament to big ambition, and its IPO is a hopeful sign for other deep tech, hard tech companies that need massive amounts of capital to change the world. It's a high wire act, but one we'll be watching with bated breath.
And that just about does it for our main set. What a fascinating range of topics today, from what we drink to how we invest to how we might fly in the future.
It really was, from the ground to the sky. As we wrap up, I think there were a few key takeaways from our discussions today. First, the importance of fundamentals is a theme that ran through the entire show. Whether it's having a rock-solid, tested data backup strategy or a founder knowing the basics of code, you can't build something great on a shaky foundation.
Absolutely. And that extends to the market itself. We saw how investors are concentrating capital on what they see as a fundamental shift, AI, in both healthcare and the broader venture landscape. This creates incredible opportunities, but it also means that if you're outside that hot new sound, your business fundamentals, your core rhythm, have to be undeniable.
And finally, with companies like HIO and Beta Technologies, we see the power of a long-term vision. HIO is tapping into a fundamental shift in consumer behavior, while Beta is taking a massive, patient swing at redefining transportation. It's a reminder that while the market chases trends, real, lasting value is often built by playing the long game.
And the common thread tying it all together, Michelle, is the music. Whether you're brewing a botanical tonic, pitching a top-tier VC, or building an electric airplane, the principles are the same. You need a unique melody to stand out, a rock-solid rhythm section of fundamentals to keep you grounded, and the creative endurance to improvise, adapt, and play the whole set no matter how tough the crowd gets. The best performers always find a way to make their music heard.
I couldn't have said it better myself. And on that note, we'll close out this episode of Startup Jazz. A huge thank you to our listeners for tuning in and sharing your time with us. And a special thanks to our sources today at Crunchbase News for their excellent reporting that fuels these conversations.
That's a wrap for us. Keep listening, keep innovating, and never be afraid to play your own tune. Until next time, stay jazzy.
You can find all the articles we discussed and subscribe to the show at startupjazz.com. We'll be back soon with a fresh set of stories. Thanks for listening.